I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
As our world has slowly shifted from feudal kingdom-based authorities to democratic nation-states with elected officials, the issue of land reform has been ever-present. Much of the angst that serfs and peasants experienced three centuries ago culminated in the French Revolution. After this monumental movement, several kingdoms gradually moved toward being nation-states, and the shift in idea of what leadership is involved a huge rewrite of land ownership. And over the last 250 years, European land ownership has been rewritten time and time again. Over the last century, it's pretty incredible what happened in Germany. People collectively chose to reconsolidate their land after the fractalization that occurred due to the Napoleonic Laws. Wait, what are the Napoleonic Laws? Napoleon abolished the status quo where land was passed from eldest son to eldest son and decreed that land would be split equally between all sons, not realizing that a few generations later, due to exponential family growth, there would not be enough land to go around. By the early 20th century, the problem festered. People owned tiny vineyard subparcels across long stretches of land. Around this time, affected regions began to discuss the possibilities of pooling their land and redistributing vineyards into more cohesive units. The problems became especially noticeable in the 1800s. This is when several regions put plans into motion to correct the extreme issues created by the Napoleonic Laws. Much of the initiative came from within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We may not hear about it too much today, but in the early 1900s, the groundwork was laid for major land redistribution. In the 1960s and 70s, land redistribution was underway in many countries in addition to Germany. In Germany, this entire process of redistribution was called, and is called, the Flurbereinigung. It affected different wine regions or Anbaugebiet in different ways, and really continues to affect them today. In the Mosel, this meant big changes in the way vineyards were farmed and harvested. Suddenly, growers could own the entire stretch of land down the hillside, and as such, they could farm it using winches, which was much more efficient than sending individual pickers to this and that parcel on the same hillside. By organizing plots north to south on the hills, and by installing roads that the multiple owners could use to transfer labor and grapes, growers were better set up for the basic tasks of farming and harvesting. Before land reorganization, you needed to fund 2,500 man-hours per hectare. After Flurbereinigung, 1,200 man-hours per hectare. This translates into tens of thousands of dollars that a winery can save just by consolidating their land. But one of the main issues still playing out today are ripples from the government-issued German law of 1971. This happened concurrent to the big changes of the Flurbereinigung. The 1971 laws constructed the concept of a Großlage, or a subregion that was particularly distinct within an Anbaugebiet. A Großlage is a large vineyard, essentially, but during land redistribution, many extremely special smaller vineyards were melded into large Großlagen. Much of the uniqueness of the Mosel's top wines were lost in the homogeny of a larger region. For instance, two special and distinct vineyards, the Erziger Krankle and the Erziger Sonnener, were both absorbed into the Erziger Wirtsgarten. This is just one of many examples. In fact, many producers today still honor the previous single vineyards with special bottlings, such as Zellbach Osler's Zeltinger Schlossberg Schmidt and Lucens Grachelhimmerich Steble. But in the Pfalz, where top-to-bottom hillside farming wasn't as much of an issue as it was in the Mosel, land redistribution meant different things. Growers could focus in on the uniqueness of their own soil. Many growers uprooted and planted their new, larger vineyards to different varieties based on soil types. This is where you see a major shift from other varieties to Riesling. The Pfalz wine growers also took the opportunity to build ditches that would help prevent flooding in the valley vineyards. And they planted specific tree areas to attract beneficial wildlife. But as these Pfalz growers ripped up old vines and worked to replant their new desired varieties, they kept finding ancient Roman artifacts. A spear, a coin, a sword, a gold crown, a sarcophagus, and then an ancient Roman villa. Vines most likely grew here wild before the Romans came. But when they arrived in 100 AD, they brought domesticated vines with them, and they changed the drinking culture of this region forever. The artifacts and archaeological sites in the faults date back to the 300s, just a couple hundred years after the Romans first arrived. In the Mosel, the new layout of vineyards made harvesting more efficient and economical, though some prized single vineyards were absorbed into a larger parcel. In the faults, as growers dug up old vineyards and worked to create the next stage of faults winemaking, they mistakenly stumbled upon winemaking's first chapter in this region. It's incredible how one winemaking renaissance is directly connected to another in the same region 1,700 years later.
Oh yes, it's Levy, and I've got some exciting, exciting news for you. 750 is now available in several more states. That's right, the amazingly powerful and easy-to-use 750 service and search tools are now available for wholesale buyers to use in Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's in addition to all the states it's already been successful in, New York, New Jersey, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Delaware. The 750 service is an amazingly powerful, simple-to-use, fundamental part of making your life as a wholesale buyer easier every day. Check it out, 750.com, for more information. That's 750.com. If you're a wholesale buyer in Boston, Chicago, D.C., anywhere in Virginia, check it out. 750 is there for you, ready to use. It's exciting. Get on it.
Andrea Franchetti on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. It's good to be in New York, and it's good to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. So you had been a restaurateur in Rome and in the Marche, and what happened next?
Well, I was going to just come back from New York City, where I stayed for almost all of the 80s. And where I was distributing wine, and I had just come back to Italy, and I just thought of opening starting a restaurant with some good local food in Rome, and the same thing in Jesi, which is in the Marche on the Adriatic coast, with local food there too, and so I thought I could do it at an arm's length, having people manage the restaurant and me being sort of the owner financial person behind it. And it didn't work. So after a month, it wasn't disastrous, but it wasn't as successful as I thought. And most of all, I had to go there more than I wanted to. So to the restaurants, I mean, so I sold it to the managers, and that ended it. But I never was a restaurateur, really. I just knew about food because I grew up also in the Marche, and my grandmother's from there, so I knew the cooking of the Marche. And I've always been a Roman. I grew up in Rome, and so I know about Roman food and how to make the right kind of Roman food as opposed to the tourist kind of restaurant that used to be. Like most restaurants used to be like then, back then. Now all the restaurants are much better.
What was the scene like in New York when you lived there?
New York, though, it was a completely different situation than today, where wherever you go, wherever you turn, you find an interesting restaurant doing some special kind of food within all possible ways of the food and all possible creativities and ideas, and from fusions to the real restitution of original foods from around the world, and it's all very well done. Then there were these, a restaurant by definition was an Italian restaurant, and it was a big gloomy place with waiters who moved slowly. It had Cosa Nostra feel to it, with the big, you know, with luxury chairs with the cardinal red coverings. And there were three or four staple plates that, and you know, the fettuccine and so forth, and wines from Tuscany or from Piedmont, Barolos, which were cheap and not even that. They weren't even marked up the way they are now. That's interesting. They were just like, the price wasn't very high for those bottles. But it was very monotonous, and those were the restaurants where you could possibly sell wine. And they were very surprised when I arrived with wines that cost 5 or 8 times more than the Italian wines they were used to buying. And I had researched these wines around North and Central Italy, and I was trying to sell them at a decent price because I thought, because there were some beautiful Italian wines to sell. And but I was a bad salesperson in the sense that I got very intimidated when I had to sell. I'm not made of the stuff of a salesman. But I loved going around Italy, picking the wines and then shipping them to New York. So for 6 years, I went on doing this and distributing the wines. And the company was called River Wine Distributing Corporation, with offices on 21st Street and in Chelsea. It was fun. And the wines actually sold because there was a curiosity and an interest for them. And they were Barolos and Barbarescos and Brunello and the first Friuli whites and a couple of very good Friuli reds. All these wines have become, have held up and are being produced today. They were, the winemakers were just beginning. Some very few winemakers in Italy were beginning to make their own way and do their own winemaking in a way that wasn't just what their fathers did. That is, if they grew up in an estate that was owned by the family, which was usually the case. It was very unusual that anybody would open a new winery in Italy, as it started happening later. So, again, the most interesting thing was seeing these new tendencies happen and taking place very shyly in Italy in the early 80s.
You were in the Siena area, Siena-Umbria kind of border. And then what happened then?
I was driving north of Rome into on the highway that goes to Florence, and halfway there's an exit which takes you in Tuscany, but right after near the border, the southern border of the Siena region, which is the southern region of Tuscany. And so you're bordering with Lazio to the south and with the Umbria to the east. And it's a vast valley, very, very empty, with no dwellings, very few houses, which were then and mostly still are ruins. And it was not the classic Tuscany that people have now called Chianti Shire, because it's so popular with the English people and many others. So this was an empty corner of Italy where I just stopped. I found this house. I asked how much it cost, and I could afford it, and I bought it along with the property around it. And when I stayed there, and when I woke up the next morning, and I went to the place, which was a ruin. I was so astounded by the landscape and by the light of the place that I found myself not leaving, and I sort of forgot about my family in Rome and just stayed there till I had put a roof on the ruin, and I put a mattress on the floor, and I was digging in the fields and messing around, and it was really empty and with no energy or anything. And I started taking care of all that. And I wanted to stay there. So in order to stay there, I had to do something there. And I decided the natural answer was to make wine, because wheat seemed too boring to me. And And that's just about all that grows in that area. So I went to Bordeaux, where I had friends, fortunately, who own chateaus and make wine. And some of them are French, some are not French. And they showed me around, and I stayed there long enough to get a feel of how many things I needed to know more about. And then I learned about those, and then I started going back and forth as the works in my farm, my new farm, had started, and I started planting. And I planted the vines like I saw in Bordeaux, in other words, 10,000 plants per hectare, which means you put a vine on each, you know, 1 meter away from the next vine on any direction. And so you need a special machinery to do that, which is not the tractor that goes into the rows, because the row is too narrow to have a tractor penetrating. So have a tractor with a bridge that takes a couple of rows under its belly, and the driver and the engine are sitting on top of the bridge. And that's how you plow and dig the soil around the vines. And then it was a matter of what kinds of vines to plant. But what I'm saying is that I was driven by an emotional realization that I wasn't in a perfect place, aesthetically speaking. I had found a place where I was very happy to be. And the reason I was happy to be there was not the society surrounding me. It was not the neighborhood. It was not people, but it was the landscape, meaning something purely very aesthetical and very emotional. If you start working in that environment, it becomes also, let's say, very ethical, in the sense that it becomes your hole, you know, where you hole up, and you're driven to continuously to better it. And that's the principle of a garden, and you make this garden around you the best way possible. And you also want to make the wine tasting the best way possible. Because there was no previous winemaking in that area, there were some vines that you could discern left in a couple of spots near the house, which was just for the farmer's own consumption. But except for that, there wasn't any wine viticulture, or certainly no appellation of any kind. The closest place where they were making wine institutionally and regularly is Montalcino, which is about 30 kilometers north of where I am. And so I started getting interested in the soil, first of all, and I had to plant in the right soil. Most of the area is blue clay, impermeable kind of soil where that is good for making vases, but not for planting, vines, because it's too plastic and it just chokes. I mean, it doesn't let the roots spread airily as they should. So the vines are sour. And but there are areas where the gravel is mixed with the clay, and or you go high enough on the mountain and you're not in the sea bottom anymore, but you're more on the eroded coast, and there you have newly broken stones, so you have erosive kind of mountain viticulture that you can do. But all these are all small strips that overall in the whole of the higher Val d'Orcia, that's the name of the valley where I found myself dwelling, are maybe 20 hectares overall. And I'm still cutting off little pieces because they're a little bit too much on clay, so there's not even that. So that my first research was about soil, because unlike other people, I wasn't looking for a certain kind of soil, but I happened to be in a place where I wanted to make wine, and so I was looking for the best soil possible to do that, which is a very different approach. now that I know more about it, I would go for a place that has the right kind of soil. But it's something that never occurred to me then. In that sense, I was fairly lucky because it was part luck and part necessity, in the sense that I found myself making wine in a place which had the predominance and a large percentage of clay in the soil mix. And that made me face the music of a certain kind of wine that I had to deal with anyway, which is a wine which is sort of force-fed in its roots because of the drainage being very slow. So that is something that you get with clay. Now, you know, clay, some people like wines that come from clay, others don't. If you go to Bordeaux, it's a 50% situation. Half the people like clay, half the people hate it. If you live in a place where it's almost only clay, you kind of hate it because you think that anything else has to be better than that. Also, clay sticks to the bottom of your shoes. It's greasy when it's wet, and it's very, very, very heavy to work with machines. Especially the machines for viticulture break immediately if they're used to the thin sands of Bordeaux, and these machines that are made for tight rows. That's what they used to work in, that kind of light soil. So once they're applied to these heavier soils, it's a nightmare. You have to change the pieces, the plows, the springs, everything. So, and that I did, and I ended up with all these hectares. In 5 or 6 years, I had planted them all, 20 of them. And it was a team of French people who came over from Bordeaux, who had planted all their lives. That was very instructive for my team because they saw these French old-timers who had a completely novel, to their eyes, approach to how you live with the vines and how you work with them. We ourselves became very good at planting. We started planting even for other people who wanted to try the tight planting system. Most of them stopped after a couple of years because you need a lot of very skilled labor, which means educating and being after the... You have to be after the viticulture almost more than if you were a true biodynamic believer, because the great thing about biodynamics is that it makes people put their faces closer to the vine, and so they start getting a sense of what a plant is and how it lives and how it progresses and what it needs and what it doesn't need, and so they have a chance to learn more the archaeology, let's say, of how to make a good wine. Before, people were not used to looking very carefully at viticulture, at least in Italy. Now this has become much better. If you have a complicated setting of vines, where the vines are very close to each other, you have to look at what you're doing very carefully and see that the plants are fine. And so you get a feel of what kind of a plant it is and how delicate or strong it is and for which reasons, and how to prune it and all that, better than if you have a large, wide planting where it's really not important how closely you follow it. So the viticulture, that went under my belt for the first 3 years, where you see the cycle every year and you learn about it. And then the first berries appear, and I started picking just as an experiment, knowing that it was experimental. And then the second time also, and at that point it was fifth leaf, 5-year-old plants. When the plants got to be 6-7 year old, I finally picked for the first time a wine that I later bottled and brought to market.
And that was what year was that?
And that was in 1997. I mean, the story is that I brought the wine to Bordeaux because that's where I knew wine people. I didn't know anybody in Italy, except I knew people, but I wasn't very interested in learning from them, so I wasn't seeing them much. But I thought you could really learn in Bordeaux from what they did in Bordeaux. And I also brought a bottle to the market there, and they sold that wine in doing their en premier offering along with the Bordeaux wines, and it went very well. And prices went up, and it went through the regular classic négoce system of the merchants of Bordeaux, which is a complicated system that is very effective in some cases. Anyway, it had nobody knew about Tenuta di Tinoro wine in Italy for the first 4 or 5 years. But internationally, they did know about it, especially because it was the time in which dot-com money had projected lots of people internationally with an interest on wine. And so Bordeaux had become suddenly a jet-set kind of scenery with people going around with Ferraris and swinging magnums of Montrachet out of the window. So it suddenly there was this, for the first time, this vision of wine almost as a fashion industry kind of item, or like star system. So in those times, you could... So that's how Tenuta di Tinoro started becoming more expensive and being drunk along with the famous wines of Bordeaux and from other places like California too. Where the same thing was happening also. I think that what I wonder about when I ask myself about how do people look for the highest quality of wine, what is a very good wine? A very good wine to a winemaker, it's easy to understand what it is if you take someone who's grown up in a classic winemaking place where there's been a bettering of all procedures in order to, that goes in a certain direction that has been placed for the last 5 centuries, like in Burgundy, say, and his father's been making wine, or the chateau has always made that certain kind of wine, and you only try to make it more so with undulating styles, in the sense that it could be a heavy wines period in which that the heaviness is a la mode, or you can go through periods in which the wine should be fresher and lighter and more mid palate because that's the style in that moment, or whatever. But still, you're in a canyon of gusto and of taste that is the canyon of the Merlot, the Cabernet Franc, and the Cabernet Sauvignon, and the Petit Verdot, and what have you, made in that particular climate with that particular wine coming out of it. And that guides you. But if you're in a completely brand new place where wine has never been made before, what are the criteria that should guide you for a direction in your winemaking? I have never made wine in classic places. I have always been gone to new places, twice. And I've done that also consulting for other people. So maybe 10 times I've started many wines in places where they had never been planted and made before. And and the thing is so you develop a different talent, which is through exercise you can learn everything, including this, including following the vision that a certain place suggests to you. And you are suggested a vision by the light and the nights and the days of a place. And staying there, it grows on you. And all the lights of the sun and the temperatures of the winds and the humidity or the dryness of the air come into your mind and become something invisible, which is locked in the secret area of your mind. And that is something that has an effect so that you keep it in mind, and it has to be translated in a code, sort of. And that code is the way you make your wine. So the place is the first thing that influences you in making a new wine, a wine that does not have a style, a recognized style that it should be made of. And so in this sort of disorder where all you have is a rich liquid because you know certain techniques like concentrating thanks to viticulture with very little berries on each plant and so forth. Sure, you have a very ripe, beautiful, powerful liquid, but that is only the raw material, which is not, even though it gets better with 10 or 15 years of aging. But while before that happens, you don't know which form, which style that you're looking for your own wine.
Because you made a wine called Palazzi for a while, and then you stopped making it.
And I also stopped making wines because I wasn't happy with what was happening, right. So it's your own evolution that dictates what you're doing, and it's also the continuing influence of... it's your conscious thought, really, that is aesthetic thought, like the one of people who cut dresses for fashion. It's a professional work of styling or that design car bodies or buildings. That together with what I mentioned before, which is the invisible in your mind, which is acting without you knowing it and transforming itself, like the outside used to transform itself from thunder to stormy weather to sun. And this sort of metamorphosis happens in your own mind. And as a result, you have some mysterious contributions that you give to the wine. That's.
Do you think that your family's background in the textile industry helped you see it more as a fashion idea in terms of cutting and...
No, it's an example that I just picked, no, because they were never really... my family is a very prominent textile family in America, on my mother's side, but they are very successful and very intelligent and very hardworking industrialists. They're not involved really with fashion as much as making money. With textiles, which is different. They make industrial textiles and chemical things like that. But that was just an example. I was thinking of fashion and the fashion industry.
Because they say you look like Yves Saint Laurent. You know, it's been said with the glasses. You know,
Yves Saint Laurent.
It's been said that you resemble him, you know.
You say I look like Fellini. So
No. So I didn't really say you looked.
Oh,
I said you're...
Because I like Fellini.
No. The style, like the speech and the type of things you say is similar.
I see.
Similar personality.
Well, they're all people that I'm glad that I remind you or other people of. I'm very happy of that because definitely the reason I stayed 20 years in Trinoro making wine in this still extraordinary wine valley, because when I go there, I just can't resist being seduced by it again, is that I'm obviously I respond very creatively to this place. It's an extraordinary place. I don't only do the viticulture and the winemaking, which through the years I've learned how to do and how to do in a way so that I, through my efforts, make a wine of a certain kind instead of just trying to save the day and avoid the wine turning into vinegar. Those are the first steps. Then you can also turn into what they like in Italy, they call it the winemaker's, you acquire winemaker's philosophy. I don't see why, it's technique really, it's not a philosophy. But they like to use this term when so you can, it's not only about using wood or not using wood or things like this that everybody now understands and knows about even outside the wine world, but I mean even people who are not directly winemakers, but it's all, there's also a lot of other stuff in the time in which you keep the wine before bottling, which is 2 years, and you have time while the wine is still not stable and to direct it in a certain direction in that period. And that's so the winemaking doesn't stop. It overlaps with the with another vintage. Actually, your winemaking, the 2013, and contemporarily, you have to go back to the 2012, and change horses completely. And so where was I? You know, it's like going to a different novel. When I went to Sicily, which was just 15 years ago, in 2000, I was just going visiting Sicily with no thoughts of wine in my head. But I then I started getting them one, and I asked myself where would be a good place to make wine in such a hot island where it's difficult to make a fine wine. You can make volume wines like they always have done in Sicily of great quality. But if you want to stress your production, you're going to find yourself with horrible alcohol levels and the sun is too hot at the wrong times of the year. So you won't be able to make a great wine in this fabled island. On the other hand, I thought Sicily is a place where it was always possible to do everything, and everything always has happened in Sicily. Everything possible has happened in Sicily. So why not look around? And I went driving, and I bumped into this huge mountain where it got very cold. And while it got very cold, suddenly it was covered with vineyards, and that was the place where, obviously, you made the great wine. But I hadn't tried that particular berry, the wine that came from Nerello Mascalese, which is the plant that wraps all around Mount Etna and grows only there only and everywhere there. And it's pale red, not sudden at all, that grows on a mountain that is over 10,000 feet high. That means that, you know, it's you have glacier on the top permanently, and so you have cold air coming down every night, and your legs, your knees hurt. It's so cold even in the summer, and then the wind of the high mountain starts, and it changes a lot. All the grapes that have all ever been planted on Mount Etna get later and later and later harvested every year because they just adjust to this difficulty by becoming late harvesting. So maybe Nerello Mascalese, which is a very late harvesting kind of plant, initially was an early harvester like a Pinot Noir, but I'm sure even though people compare it a lot with Pinot Noir because it's fine and light and lithe, like Pinot Noir, it is not Pinot Noir at all. I mean, it's a different creature for sure. And it did go in bulk for decades to places where they did make Pinot Noir, and they had phylloxera up in France and Burgundy, and they and the Macron. I mean,
this was in the 1900s, like 1910, 1920.
It was from the 90s to the 10s, 20s, 30s, and then it ended there during the 30s. So it was a completely abandoned place because that was their market. And when that market shut, and then the war came also, but until from the 30s to until now, there was nothing going on. Everything was abandoned, very, very gloomy, but with big shapes of ancient chateaus all over the mountain. And I went and bought one of them, the highest and the largest, that they had told me about. And I immediately recognized the potential of that place, because not only, and also the giant that Mount Etna is with its eruptions, and it's unbelievable if you haven't seen it. You just want to try to make wine in a place like that because you know as a winemaker what it means in the sense of the incredible opportunities that lie there, and because of you want to be part of a place that is so unique, which is has nothing to do with the winemaking, but it's irresistible. And then later on, you find out that many other people feel the same thing, and to the point that when today there are 70 producers, and it's a little strip on the north side of the mountain. That's the only area where wine is really made on Mount Etna. And the steeper and higher you go, the more terraced it is, and so you only have small sections. The acreage is really cut up in small pieces. It's not an easy, and it's very, it's not a cheap viticulture to do. Anyway, when I first had that wine, I didn't like it very much, the wine made with Nerello Mascalese, and I tried to make it better, but I did it the wrong way because I tried to do it like I would do with the grape that I need to concentrate more, doing the kind of viticulture that does that, and the winemaking that extracts more to have a thicker juice, in other words. But that was not the right, what I should have done, but it took me 10 years to realize that, because it's like changing completely your way of dressing or cooking or some fundamental behaviors. And it's something you don't do unless you're lucky, I would say. It's a matter of being lucky in this case, that you suddenly see another way, and it's an image that drives you. And in this case, it was an image of a pale-colored, cosmic, sort of royal juice of a Venetian red that comes from a very high, tall mountain, and that this very fine wine is the answer, almost transparent, almost like a white wine with very little matter in it, very little, not a suave. This was an image, and by following that direction, I found a way of making Nerello, I think, at least the way it should be, taste the best way Nerello can taste, which means really applying techniques that are different in the winemaking. So while I initially just wanted to plant my own vines on the mountain, I ended up making the Nerello, which I found there as a principal, as a main job on the mountain. Now, this thing about going to a place and be very attracted to it and really not knowing what to do but wanting to stay there means that there is something you are finding that you don't know what it is yet, but it means that you sort of found yourself suddenly on a path that you don't want to leave, though you don't know what that path is at all. And if you have always lived in the city, like almost all of us, and you go to a place where the only house is 30 miles in a certain direction, but the whole valley is very beautiful and welcoming, and you feel, you know, what's happening to you there is that you are beginning to go to change your life completely, because if you start living there, you can either, it could become a weekend thing, so you go there for the weekends and you have fun building your house and doing your garden from Friday to Sunday night. But if you instead you just move there with an excuse like that of making wine, you find that an excuse to stay there, I mean, all the time, then you will find that your whole existence changes. Now, people in America, there is a huge tradition of the wilderness holding up the spirit of this country. You can still go west, and if you can't even live on the Oregon coast because it's just too wild. You have to move back a little bit, and so that the sea is in sight, because it's just too wild and violent. So there's plenty of wilderness and a lot of people who are fed up with the life they have been moving out in the wilderness, and it's an American tradition. It's a great patrimony of this country. It has a different meaning here because in America, nature is not beat. Nature still overwhelms, and so if you go into the wilderness, you're going to change your life, and you know it. You know when you do that. In a place like Italy, where nature has been beat century after century and manicured, and where every spot of country has an old ruin next to it, you might be just as lonesome, but you are in a different kind of atmosphere, which is a cultural atmosphere, which is very comfortable because you can restore it a little bit by redoing the meadows that had been left, repatching up the walls that had been that's the same thing in New York State, really, you know, and changing the reason for the cultures in that place, and really you break your back while you're doing this. It's not something you can do. And the only way to do it is really if you're making decisions like in viticulture every minute of the day or every day, then you have to intervene yourself. You have to do things with your own hands, or do it together with other people who are helping you, other workers, to show them how you want it done. So this has obviously a physical effect of great exercise, and that also changes you, and you start to live by the sun and the moon and the seasons and the vegetation, and these forces take over and change you completely. So I think that there are some pioneering winemakers that have gone through that experience, and I know several in Italy. And when they make wine, it's really the summing up the story of the whole past year. And that's part of why it's so exciting to make wine, because the wine is also a document of the year that has passed, where you've been, remember, outdoors all the time. And in Italy, there is a drive for nature, and people going looking for nature. These swings have always happened, especially when there's economic problems and people also problems of not being satisfied with the life you're leading, you know. And then people start talking about nature very much. And talking about nature is a fountain of misleadings and mistakes, because you risk becoming a worshipper of a broccoli or something, or a carrot, and it's much more complicated than that. But if you go in the country, you learn what nature is and how, and also about your own nature. But to go back to the wine, I think that in these years I've been able to shape slowly these wines by repeating them every year into both on Mount Etna in Sicily and in Tuscany, in Val d'Orcia, if you can call it Tuscany. For the first few years I didn't even know it was in Tuscany. I realized afterwards that it was in Tuscany. Shaping them into something that I know I need to repeat, and that is and that has its own character, its own style to itself. So it's a re-edition of in a different way of that single vintage of a certain opera, of a certain kind of expression. Those who understand wine can recognize. So I think this is a big achievement that happens very, very slowly, hasn't completed itself yet, But because it can always be extended. But it makes the whole adventure of marching into the countryside something with that has also, you also have the satisfaction of a very solid document of something that you've done.
When you dealt with the Norello, you also planted Petit Verdot and Cesanese in Sicily, and you had those in Tuscany. What was it like to work with those grapes in different places?
Yes, when you want to make a new wine, you have to look at some parameters so that you won't. Once you plant it, you can't. It's too long to change what you've done. So you have to think about how, if it's a vine is a late harvester, in other words, if it ripens in a given place, say in central Italy or in France, Petit Verdot will ripen in the second half, end of October, so late compared to, say, Pinot Noir that will ripen in the middle of September. So there can be big differences. And that's just the cycle of the plant. So if you take that grape and you plant it in a place where the latitude is much lower, like in Sicily, you know that you're going to, whatever you're planting will be ripening a month and a half earlier because there are 2,000 kilometers from where that plant grows and the new place you're bringing it to. On the other hand, if you don't want it to ripen too fast because you are in a place that might be too hot, and so that would just burn it out and burn out its fruit, and it would shrivel under the sun while it's ripening. So instead, you want it to be in the cool weather of fall before you pick it. So that's one consideration, the cycle of the plant, and then the latitude and the altitude. If a place is up on a mountain, it's going to be ripening even later. So the altitude, the Mount Etna balances the latitude of being so far south in Sicily. And so those are the sort of mechanical decisions you make, and then you have a taste in mind. What might those two grapes mixed together give you as a taste? Do I like the idea of that kind of taste combined with that, what that soil does on that mountain, that black soil on Mount Etna, which is so spicy and sort of lacking in body but very heady? And would it do well with what I know the wines from those kinds of berries can be like? And that's something you have to just imagine. And so you reach a decision. In this case, it was Cesanese, which is a very late harvester that grows south of Rome. And it's a very aromatic red grape. And I planted a couple of patches of that, and I also planted a couple of patches of Petit Verdot, which is a late harvested grape that grows in Bordeaux. More thick-skinned, much blacker wine than the Cesanese, but they actually do ripen in the middle of August, which is a good time because you're far away from any damage coming from the rains. And so I planted those, and then I started mixing them when the plants were old enough to yield berries, and I made a wine called Franchetti, which has my name because it's just a different wine
than the Pasco Pastrano,
than the Nerello Mascalese wines that come from a plant that grows already indigenous to the mountain. So it was brought; they were brought by me, and they turned out to be good wines for what I wanted to do. Of course, some years are better, some years are worse, but it's a very thick black wine that has a sort of a marzipan and citron flavor and taste. And then with aging, it ages well, because those are grapes that I knew already that the juice of those grapes ages very nicely.
And you also experimented with white wine with the Guardiola in Sicily. And I don't think you had made white in Tuscany. So a new thing for you at that time.
Yes, it was a new thing. There's the plants of Nerello Mascalese, red grape that grow all over Mount Etna. Every 10 or 20, there's a plant of white. Like it used to be in Chianti, or it used to be on the Rhone, or in many places. But they used to mix it all in and to have a more graceful wine when you had it on your table. There, they've been making wine by squeezing all the grapes that come into the winery that they set aside, because they only want to make the reds, and then they take all the, at the end of the harvest, they take all the whites, press them together. And it's 5, 6, 7 different plants that grow on Mount Etna. Some of them come from Greece, some of them, they're different plants. The result is less than exciting. And so I've always thought that if you want to make a wine, you have to use one of the great, great grapes, which there are only 3 of in the white realm, which are Chenin Blanc, Riesling, and Chardonnay. Even though Chardonnay is so boring because everybody talks about it, still that doesn't take away the fact that it's one of the great top kinds of fruit. And then, otherwise, if you want to make a red, you have to use Cabernet or Merlot, Pinot Noir if you can, if the place is okay. You know, and Cabernet Franc, there's not many others. Those are the ones. And the others are second rate compared to these. Just the way the Sauvignon Blanc is less good than Chardonnay. They're good, but they're second rate. The plants, the white grapes on Mount Etna are sort of fourth rate. So I planted Chardonnay way up at 1,000 meters on terraces on the north side there in my property in Mount Etna, and it was and it's doing very well. You have to pick it quickly and not let it, you can't let it go all the way through its ripening like they do in Chablis, because it would turn into a Californian kind of very fat, greasy, alcoholic white. So you have to stop it and pick it when it's about 12.5 in alcohol, or 19 in sugar percentage, and it's just beginning to develop and to turn into a fruit, into the grape start, you can having fruit and not just acidity. And by picking it that way, I made a Chardonnay, which is very hard to age because it's picked sort of while it's still hard and then fresh. And it needs more bottle time that I've been able to keep it. I've been able to keep it only for short periods. I would like to keep it for a whole year and a half more. But it will, it after a few years, it becomes a great, it will become a great wine. I haven't seen it change enough yet.
I found the fruit somewhat interesting. I mean, what's interesting you said about the Chardonnay as a variety, because sometimes your Chardonnay doesn't super remind me of Chardonnay. No. In terms of the fruit, it reminds me sometimes more of like a Viognier or a Pinot Gris. It's just fruity, you know.
Yep.
I don't mean it's to be true. Disrespectful, but that's...
No, there's nothing wrong. I mean, who cares about the taste of Chardonnay? Fine with me. It's just the wine that counts, you know. And I'm glad it doesn't really taste too much like Chardonnay, which can be really nauseating, maybe. But, I mean, it's true, and that's what... And I like that about this wine, because it makes it possible to use the grape as a tool. Instead of making wine, it's like if you're making a Chardonnay. Chardonnay is a grape, it's not a wine. You're making wine. I don't think people should even know about what the wines are made out of. They should just appreciate the wine and not... Of course, it's helpful to know in the labyrinth of all these labels. But It's the wine that counts and not the varietal. And certainly the lava takes, sort of cuts the Chardonnay motive out of the fruit and just lets it have a nice fruit. It's really the limestone that makes that kind of... Or in California, as soon as it ages a little... I mean, if you pick it a little later, then the Chardonnay factor explodes and you really taste it. Also, I don't use wood, which is very often associated with the white wines of Chardonnay. And I only make it steel for fermenting and then cement for aging.
In 2009, you introduced a selection of different vineyards from Pasco Pistrero. Nerello, usually old vine, different elevations. How did those bottlings differ for you?
When I owned the small plots up and down the mountainside, and when I harvested the grapes, I realized that the grapes coming from certain areas when we brought the grapes in were very different in taste than the others. And so I pulled them out of the mix and made them by themselves as a single Contrada vineyard wines. Now, a Contrada is an old property in Sicily, and they're all over Italy, and they're fairly well bought. People know where one Contrada ends and another one starts. Then later on, these feudal properties got obviously cut up in different ownerships. But the difference with Mount Etna is that the Contrada in Mount Etna lay each one on a single lava spill. So the mineral mix of the ground of one Contrada is completely different from the mineral mix of the ground of another Contrada. The soils are different. And so you can have, let me give you an example. Lava comes out of the top of the mountain or from a mouth that opens after some explosions and on the side of the mountain, and the lava starts gushing out. And if it's a big situation with a lot of pressure, then the lava will keep running down the side of the mountain and not stop way up high, but keep going down all the way to where the vines are cultivated. That happens very rarely, but it has happened very much in the last thousands of years. As the lava comes down, it goes a meter an hour. It's like a thick paste, that a wall that is slowly coming down, eating up the woods and the trees, but it's very slow. Sometimes it's like water. Overnight, it'll go all the way down, reach the bottom of the valley. And it's even dangerous because it comes too fast and people can't get away from their homes in time. I mean, they always can, but I mean, it's that fast. And so this gives you an idea of how different the mix and the substance of the lava, which is fished out of 5,000 meters down into the crust of the earth, can be. So it brings up all this material, which then takes really... a whole century before you can cultivate it. And as it dries in so many different ways that's another variable. So it can be, in powder, very thin powder, like face powder or gravel, big gravel, thin gravel, everything. So one Contrada is one old property. And a lava spill comes down and it spreads out and it creates a beautiful plain, which later becomes a property. So each Contrada is, again, for mechanical reasons, really, it sits on one lava spill. And there, the vines are going to taste different. I mean, the fruit is going to taste different from the next vineyard if it's on another lava spill. And that's a fascinating situation of Mount Etna, that you can have crews that are extraordinarily different one from the other. And we're trying to By making wine, me and other producers there were trying to highlight this and find a really and already a graduatory of the quality of different contrade is appearing, in the sense that there are three or four contrade that seem to be the best, and we share them and cultivate them. And it's a very interesting and ongoing work, but it was picked up very quickly by people, the public, the consumers, the wine lovers have picked on this idea very rapidly, more than I would have ever thought.
You think that's because of other people also doing it, or do you think that's because of the Burgundy model?
I think the Burgundy model really helped, and it's also helped that in the sense that the producers were happy to imitate it. Because in a new place, when you're starting all over in an abandoned place like that, you're confused and anything is good to recognize. But I think it happened because there's an extraordinary communication in the wine world, more than in any other segment of what we do. Yeah, and so things like what we're saying right now, which 5 or 6 years ago would have sounded, you know, like first time and crazy, already something people have heard about and are interested in. And this is because there's an amazing amount of intelligent people who are forwarding the new what's going on in the wine world.
And you're friends with Frank Cornelison on the island.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And you guys spend time and talk about wine.
Yes. Yes. Well, you can talk about wine all night with Frank, and he's the only person that it's interesting to talk about wine with that I know on Mount Etna, really. I don't want to be shitty towards other people working there, but I mean, there are many kinds of entrepreneurs and producers, and from naive to very commercial to every possible, they come from, but every possible way of life. But Frankie, he's asking himself which is the best possible wine he can make, and with which materials and which grapes on Mount Etna, and he does Nerello with such passion and carefulness that it is, you know, it's viticulture done with his own hands, that he brings a Northern European. He's a Flemish person, you know, and he brings this almost fanatic single-mindedness and passion to what he does. So it's very different to what other people do. Also, he knows all about wines across Europe, and which is not common, and so he's always thinking which grape could fit here, and is this similar to that? He has a lot of references in his mind, so there's a lot to talk about.
Speaking of grapes, I see that you mostly use Nerello Mascalese in Sicily as opposed to Nerello Cappuccio. Why would that be? Well, you know, they're both native grapes of the region. Why?
They're cousins, first of all. They're not very different. Nerello Cappuccio is a soft wine, ripens a little earlier, it's slightly darker, but it's really very hard to distinguish, though you get to learn how to. But it's also almost irrelevant because it's like pepper on a huge salad. There isn't many plants of Nerello Cappuccio, and they're just mixed in everywhere with the Nerello Mascalese kind. So most people don't really look at what they don't see. They don't care about the difference because they know that it's going to be a 1% ingredient, the Nerello Cappuccio, that is coming in. So they're not even going to bother about it, and you will make a better wine with Nerello Mascalese than with Nerello Cappuccio, so you might as well. I mean, it's not worth doing whole patches of straight Nerello Cappuccio.
And you make a dessert wine on Sicily.
Well, with those white grapes I told you about at the end, we should put them aside, cases full of white grapes, and then we hung them on the ceiling for 2 or 3 months and then squeezed them when they were a little shriveled, and we got this very sweet juice, which then I would ferment, and the effect of all this procedure and both the kind, the grape kinds and the bacteria they collected while hanging up there, it was because I'm not making that wine anymore, but it was about 1,000 half bottles every year of sweet wine that smelled and tasted and had a strong taste of saffron, which was probably its best side. It was something between peasant and higher up.
Speaking of that, I mean, what's it like interacting on the island of Sicily? I mean, I imagine you have shepherds in the area and people who have lived there for a very long time in the area, and yourself. And
yes, there is the population is very easy to get along with. They're just farmers and mountain people who are very, you know, pristine people who are not. They're not. No racketeering, to mention of like you could find in larger cities. It's not that you have a problem with the mafia or anything like that. None of us have ever had anything like that. But there are a large number of. I mean, the whole mountain is rented out or claimed by shepherds, and the shepherds have, when I say claimed, it doesn't belong to them, but they still use it as grazing ground, which is the case with shepherds anywhere in the world. But so when there was a crisis of wine and the vineyards receded down the slope down Mount Etna, they just came in, and now they need to be pushed back a little bit higher up the mountain or in other areas that which are not just the northern side, because there is the reality of a new viticulture which is happening there, which is reclaiming where the old vines used to be. So there are some frictions, which just what happens is that you get a terrible fire when the winds are right, which means that they're really howling in the direction of your own vineyard, and they light up the bush. And this terrible fires with 30 meter long, 90 feet flames come rushing up, and it's really dangerous, and you want to be lucky, you know, when that happens. But it doesn't damage the matter of fact that the last wine I made, the 012 bottling of my Franchetti wine, is very fumé because of the smoke that came into the grapes. I don't mind it at all. It's an interesting feature, but it's through negotiations and the inevitable dialogue that starts in a situation like this. You know, they these things like this will stop. You know, but this is arson that goes on. You know, and so this was the only disagreeable thing that happened. To people like me and others who have come to make wine, to have trouble with shepherds.
You've had a history in terms of wine as being a little bit of an explorer, finding an area that hadn't quite reached the public consciousness, and then working there to some success in both areas. What might be next for Andrea Franchetti?
I would like to make a Cabernet Sauvignon on sand, because that's the best way to make Cabernet Sauvignon. And there are some sandy areas in Italy, in central Italy, that are fabulous, near the sea and also inland. and that's the only thing that really I can think of as a very, very nice wine one could make that would be, I think, successful and very quickly could become a great wine. Cabernet Sauvignon is slowly dropping off the planting more Cabernet Franc than Cabernet Sauvignon, in Tuscany, which is where they plant most of it, and in Italy. And I think that to make, and the reason is that Cabernet Sauvignon needs to be in a not very heavy kind of soil like you have in Tuscany, where there's too much clay or rock. It needs to be in a gentle, sandy soil, and there you can make an extraordinary Cabernet Sauvignon. So that's something I'd like to do, but I would like to do a small thing, you know. But I think I have enough to do, and with my places in Tuscany and in Mount Etna, they do well, fortunately. But it took a long time to bring them to this, and if you start making wine, make it in a small amount and don't expect results to be, break even after 10 years, and if you can keep that going with a small profit, that's really the way it should be, and it means that you've done really well.
Yeah. Andrea Franchetti, he's done well in both Tuscany and Sicily. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Andrea Franchetti.
Oh yes, it's Levy, and I've got some exciting, exciting news for you. 750 is now available in several more states. That's right, the amazingly powerful and easy-to-use 750 service and search tools are now available for wholesale buyers to use in Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's in addition to all the states it's already been successful in: New York, New Jersey, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Delaware. The 750 service is an amazingly powerful, simple-to-use, fundamental part of making your life as a wholesale buyer easier every day. Check it out, 750.com, for more information. That's 750.com. If you're a wholesale buyer in Boston, Chicago, D.C., anywhere in Virginia, check it out. 750 is there for you, ready to use. It's exciting. Get on it. The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show, offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers.
And that's our show today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe.